It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Cowboy Stories and welcome to part two of my interview with Skeet Gould. If you haven't had a chance to listen to part one, head over and listen to that first because we are going to dive right in.
I was up there once, and the crew was up there, and they left me on a stand, on a holdup, and they were going to work that country down to me. I was supposed to stop the cattle, and they were supposed to come out a certain draw. It's rocky. There was just solid rock from there. And I heard rocks rolling behind me. So I thought, well, they missed their deal, so I loped back down there. And I don't know what he was doing, but there's no boy leading three pack horses, and he was trotting and loping. And he avoided me. I don't know what he was doing. Maybe butchering beef. But I didn't try to stop him.
Yeah.
Even though we were all armed, I always carried a gun, but he didn't try to stop him. If he was up there butchering the beef, he's welcome to it. And, it's quite a country. More water on that mountain than you would think.
Really?
And out on the desert between the mountain and highway, there were quite a few wild cattle in that country, and we were catching some of those cattle and tied them to trees and then lead them out to a trailer. But we found a place there one day. There were two or three horses tied to fences, to trees, I mean, and a camp there, and nobody there. Those horses had been there for a few days, and they were drawn up. We turned the horses loose, but always wondered what happened to those guys, whether they got lost or whether they got dead, you know. But it's pretty interesting country. But that ranch changed hands, and so I left. I think I went to the Double O's from there. I didn't. I went to the Yolo's from there. Gene Smith was one of the best cowboys and best bosses I ever worked with. The bunkhouse was full, so I got to stay in house with Gene. He was married, but his wife lived in town. So every night, Gene would tell stories, and he was, I think, 67 at that point. He'd worked at Babbitt's, you know, in the 30s, and he'd been around a lot, been in New Mexico a lot, been hurt a lot. Gene was one of those guys that broke every bone in his body, I think. But he was very quiet-spoken and very polite, and he never chewed anybody out. I never heard him chew a man out, a cowboy out. And I said something about it once, and he said, "Skeet, if a man makes a mistake, he's going to know it." And he said, "If he's so dumb he doesn't know it, it won't do any good to chew him out." So that was his theory. He just, you know. One day we were working off down in Granite Creek, I think's the name of it, I'll think of it. And there was a little bunch of cattle up above us. That country's rough and it's brushy. He said, "Skeet, go up there and get those cattle if you would." And they had a little hold up there. And a little bunch of cattle stopped, and I was supposed to go bring what was up there. So I had to go way around. I got above these cattle and I started down with them, and there was a cow and a calf and two dry cows. The two dry cows were running off, and I let them go. I put that pair into the holdup, and Gene didn't say anything. Those other cows were gone. Didn't say anything. That night, he said, "Skeet, we don't like to drive through a bunch of cattle. We don't like to turn cattle loose." I said, "Well, Gene, I'd have had to rope those cows." And he said, "I wish you had." And that's all he ever said. "You didn't chew me. I didn't say, you dumb old kid, you know." two or three things like that, that, you know, I saw another kid make a bad mistake. He never said a word to him in front of anybody. He might have chewed him out later or said something to him, but Gene could really rope. Tried not to rope outside. He knew the country, really knew that country, knew every trail. I was with him once, and there was some cattle running off. And we were on a different trail, and I knew we could get in front of them. But Gene just kind of easing off down the trail. I mean, slow loping and trotting, and I was about to bump into him and want him to go. But we got there in front of the cattle and got him stopped. And I said something about it. I said, "Man, I thought you'd go faster than that." He said, "Didn't need to, you know." And he was handy.
He sounds like a guy you could learn a lot from.
Oh, man. And I was there in 1963. We were camped at Barney Wells. Woke up in the morning, it was snowing. 13th of December. And it's not supposed to snow that much at Barney Wells. It's only about 4,000 foot elevation. But Gene and Monk said, well, Monk was camped at Stogis with his wife and family. They decided to go to town or go to camp. And so they left. It just kept snowing. Floyd and Slim Allman and I went to Baghdad and bought some whiskey and got back to camp, and it just kept snowing. And I don't remember exactly, but it snowed 3 or 4 feet right there. And that horse pasture was just a big rock pile, and we fed those horses our little Ramuza, you know, whatever, 50 head of horses. We fed them Bermuda cubes, but we ran out of cubes. So I said, well, I'll take this Ramuza and I'll go to Stogis with them because there's a barn full of feed. And I pulled out, and about halfway, I think it's 7 miles, about halfway, Bertha Shell lived there, and there's just been an article about Bertha had a bunch of goats. What a character. What a character. And her shed where she had her goat feed was snowed in. She couldn't get it. She was old. She couldn't get into that shed, so I shoveled it out for her, and she said, come in, get a cup of coffee. I went in her house. She had goats and dogs in her house. Goats on the kitchen table.
Oh, boy.
Pretty rank. Then I went on. I was packing my bed on a horse called Egypt. And I got on up there. It snowed right at 6 feet up at Stogis.
Wow.
And then it rained a little bit on it, and it settled out to maybe 4 feet. But there was a crust on it. But there were a lot of cattle right out of the trap there and to the north, you know. A lot of cattle, and they were kegged up under those juniper trees, and everything wouldn't go. And so I booted a couple horses with inner tubes and Levi pants to where it wouldn't skin them going through that ice. And I went and broke trail, and I got a whole bunch of those cows out of there. Like I said, it started on the 13th. Christmas Eve, I was trying to chop ice for those cows in a little dirt tank. And I heard something, and I looked, and I thought I could see some snow moving, and then I see a black puff of smoke. And Gene Kreiner had walked a cat in there from Baghdad. What a relief. Anyway, and I got home for Christmas Eve, you know. But that was quite a spring. So that spring, it snowed down off for the most part, and the cattle had kicked off into Barney Wells and Scott's Basin, which is, I don't know, 2,000 feet, no snow. So Gene put me down there in Barney Wells again, and he said, just range bound all those calves that you can get to. And a bunch of steers had been turned out with yearling steers that still had horns, and he said, catch those steers and dehorn them, tip them. And he coached on me. He said, Skeet, hold those cattle up. Don't just run and rope. Try to keep them as gentle as you can. Get them stopped. Slip around and try to catch a calf and tie him down. Go stop those cattle and bring them back. And that country's pretty steep and pretty brushy, rocky. Stop them again. Hold them up. Catch another calf if you can. And then brand them. But keep them held up. And I don't know how many, Brian, it don't matter. Not as many as maybe I could have. I de-owned quite a few of them. But I learned a pile. I learned a bunch about stopping bad cattle. Not bad cattle, just those cows were just pretty fast company. You know, they weren't really wild. If they'd run, they'd all run from you. I learned a bunch. And I really appreciate Gene giving me that chance, because not many guys, even in my lifetime, would have done that, let you go learn to do that kind of stuff. I stayed at the Yolos 11 months. That's the longest I'd ever stayed anywhere in my life. And then I went to work at San Carlos. And I had learned I could preg check and inseminate, which I got made fun of for that. But
really?
Yeah. Well, that's not cowboy, you know. Gotta go to a dang squeeze shoot. But I got hired and went to a camp they called Horse Camp at R100, Arsenic Tubs. It's really, that's really, really good cow country. I'll back up a minute. I was at a field day once with my dad on, it was Ash Creek country on the reservation. Henry Boyce, the Boyce family owned Jericho Cattle Company. When they shipped 20,000 mother cows off that country. And that was the country that that I worked with Milton Foreman. Mr. Boyce was talking, and he said he had run cattle in several countries all over the United States, in most states in the United States, in Brazil, and on, Australia. He said, as far as I'm concerned, you're standing on the best cow country in the world. It is good country. It's good country. So I was back further east and gathered, I think we had 500 vials of semen. I don't remember for sure, but anyway, we gathered a bunch of cows, all Hereford cows, all horned Herefords, nearly all horned. And the cows that they cut for me to breed, a lot of them were they'd never had a baby in their life. They were barren. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any mammary development. They didn't have any bag. And I said, you know what? It's not going to work to breed these cows. Oh, what you've got. And the corrals were falling down. And it was hard. I had a helper, Henry Tesse, maybe. I don't think so. Henry was his first name. But we had trouble pinning those cows. And so my big boss came by, and I told him, I said, Gunner, I'm having trouble pinning these cows, or we are. And he said, rope them. And I said, well, I'd be glad to. I was riding young horses. He said, I'd be glad to rope them. But I said, they're not going to stick. Rope them. So I did. I got to rope, I don't know how many cows, but I roped quite a few cows and made good horses. But later I found out, I left and moved to another outfit on the reservation, but later I found out that about 50% of those cows bred. So not a highly successful experiment. But then I went to Slaughter Mountain. Well, I rode a bunch of colts there, IDT colts, and man, they were sorry suckers. And I got a couple of pictures of them, and they were little, sorry little horses. They did as good as they could do, but they just didn't have it. There are a lot of Mustangs better looking than they were. And I went to Slaughter Mountain, which is a really neat piece of country. And they bought a bunch of colts from New Mexico. Dugan, I think, was the guy's name that brought them to us. And they were all put together horses. There was one of them had a DRU brand on his left hip. Obviously called him Drew. There was another horse that had a hairpin on his right hip. And I think maybe there were two of them. But they'd all buck. Every one of them would buck. There was a big black horse they called Joe Lewis. And he'd buck, and he could buck. But they only bucked me off once. And I'm proud of that. They only bucked me off once. But Joe Lewis made a hell of a horse, and I got to rope a lot of cattle. They head and heeled everything there, and that's one of the only places in Arizona I ever was where they head and heeled Brannon. And everything had to be outside. I think there were several hundred or a couple hundred brands registered to Slaughter Mountain.
Wow.
And every Indian, every Apache could own cattle if he had, I don't know how they got started for sure, but every cow would have an individual's brand on them. So a calf had to be mothered up. And they had to really be mothered up to not just kind of think. They had to be mothered up. And Nelson Duane got to drag almost every calf. He was an Apache, and I don't know how old he was for sure, but old, and he's crippled in his shoulders. And everybody tied. I dallied, but everybody else tied. But Nelson would slip around in our herd, open herd outside, no fences. And he could reach to the end of his, like, 30-foot rope, 35-foot rope. And he couldn't raise his hand past his shoulder, higher than his shoulder, but he could throw that rope to the end of the tied to the horn. A lot of times it would just be about the size of, you know, not much bigger than a calf's head, and just bell collar him right around the neck. Come to the fire and holler out which brand was on that calf, and then I'd got to heal him, and that's damn near all of them. So I made a good horse or two. I want to brag a little. There was an Indian boy there, and I cannot say his name right now, and he was a pretty good friend. But I had reached and roped a calf pretty good one day, and he came up to me, and those guys, most of them talked with an accent back then. He said, "Man, Skeet, every time you rope, it looks like the 4th of July." That made me pretty proud. And I stayed there quite a while, and got to rope some wild cattle. They built a trigger trap, a new trigger trap, back up in there, Sienega Creek. Man, what a pretty country and good country. And trapped a bunch of big cattle. 6 big steers, I think. I mean, like 3 and 4 and 5 year old steers. And they brought a horse truck in there, you know, a little bobtail. We caught those steers and drug them all in that truck. And we're just leaving. There's a maverick bull, about a 3-year-old bull, come up out of that draw. And I said, "Look at that." And I ran and roped him, riding Joe Lewis. But I was really loose. I'd loosened my saddle up, and I was about to lose the pack. Bobby was that Indian boy's name. And Bobby come over, and I said, "Catch that bull, Bobby." And he did. He roped him. Held him off of me, and I got off and was resetting my saddle. And he let that sucker get to me, and it bull hooked me and knocked me down. But anyway, then Bobby choked him to death. I said, "Bobby, give him some air, give him some air." He didn't give him any air, killed him. He said, "That'll teach that sumbitch to hook you." But anyway, I stayed around quite a while. From Slaughter Mountain to Calva, where they sold cattle at that time on the reservation, they had auctions at Calva, and they sold cattle, all the cattle there, and they'd sell them on whatever day it was of the week, I don't remember. The next week, all those cattle would be shipped, and they'd bring another set of cattle in. 8 ranches on that reservation. And it took 8 days to walk those cattle from Slaughter Mountain to Calva. And got down there. Well, I'm going to back up. He'd stop and noon out, you know, eat lunch and let those cattle. They didn't have to night herd. But anyway, I got off and sat down on the ground and went to sleep. When they finally come woke me up, the herd was down the country about 1/2 mile. Pretty embarrassing. Then got down there to Calva, and crossing that highway and the river right there, we had to rope quite a few of those cattle to get them across there. They'd never seen pavement. Most of them, a lot of them, had never seen running water. Wow. Then got them in his corrals, and And truly, a lot of those cows, most of them, had never seen a water trough. I mean, it was all live water, dirt tanks, and running water, just creeks, springs. So they had to run those troughs over to water cattle on the ground. They'd never been fed a bale of hay. True story, they'd never seen a bale of hay. Or any other, they'd been fed a little salt, and that's it. So they had to feed them on the ground. And then one of the first days we were there, a railroad track runs right through the, right by the pens, and they shipped a lot of cattle on the rail. And I was horseback doing something, and all of a sudden, hear a train toot their horn way off down the country, and all those Indian boys went running and climbing out of there, and I didn't know what was going on. That train come by there, woo, woo, and it stampeded those cattle. They'd sure never seen a train. They ran, they wiped a lot of fence out. A lot of the water troughs, they flattened.
Oh.
It was a wreck, you know, and it has happened several times. You learn to get out of the way when you hear a railroad train.
That reminds me of that other story that you wrote in your book about all those cows getting taken out by the train.
Yeah, that was in the feedlot. Yeah, that was a scary deal. Then, I think I wrote about it too, but there was an Indian boy who came down there with Point of Pines, a Mexican boy, I mean, Ernesto Casillas, and this guy was a cowboy and a horseman, could really rope. His horn on his saddle was a brass neck, maybe 3 inches high, and it looked like maybe a tennis ball on top. But he could dally on that brass. And they wanted to butcher beef, and the way they butchered there was come out of a pen, go in and pen and catch whatever you're going to butcher and take him out a long alley and get down there and head and heel him, and they'd knock him in the head and butcher. Anyway, I'd roped this big heifer and I was coming out there, and she's fighting me. She's hooking me and I'm trying to, and we were in a dead run coming out of it. And Ernesto sitting on my right, on the right side, swinging a big loop. I come by him just flying, and he reached the rope that heifer by both feet. I thought, okay, big boy. And he dallied, the smoke was rolling, but anyway, he stopped her. What a cowboy.
On that brass horn.
On that brass horn.
That's cool.
I tried dallying on a brass horn. It's slick. But Ernesto, they told me, had roped 3 bears that fall at Point of Pines.
Wow.
And handled them. He said a 300-pound bear feels like a 1,000-pound cow on a rope. But anyway, it was quite an experience, you know. I really liked it. I loved medicine where Dad was, and I just loved it. If it weren't owned by the Apaches, or if they hadn't quit hiring white men, I might still be there. I really liked the country. And I got a lot of respect for the people, but that fell apart, and I went to California, which changed everything. But then talk about Arizona some more. I got married and went back down there. Well, I'm back up again some more. I was working there at Calva for those sales, and my wife, Dad, and Granddad had bought a lot of cattle there. And the one sale, my future father-in-law and future bride had flown down there, and we were all pretty taken with my future bride. And I was talking to those. They left. They flew in there in a little plane, and they left, and I was teasing those Indian boys, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go to California, I'm going to marry her, and I'll be back here next year buying cattle. And it almost happened that way. But we did get married and came back to Arizona. First went to the Olos, to Barney Wells, which was pretty primitive camp for a California girl. But I didn't like the new management. Gene Smith is long retired. Anyway, Ben Fancher came to see me, and he said, Skeet, he was going to quit. He was working for Babbitt's, staying at called Cataract Well. And he was going to quit and go to running the Poquette Ranch. And he said, that job's open if you want it. So I didn't even have to think about it. We went up there and went to work for Babbitt's. And we got our mail at the Grand Canyon. And I don't remember, it's 30 miles of dirt road or something like that to that camp. And another 50 miles to Grand Canyon. That's where we got our mail. And I love that canyon, you know, my wife. It is so neat. I could look at it every day and never get tired of it. We ate quite a bit in El Tovar Hotel. And, you know, I was making, I think, $250 a month when I went to work there. Babbitt's furnished all the groceries. Anything but beef that they had. They have those stores that are just like a Safeway or any other big grocery store. Any food item that you needed in there, you could have it. Mops, soap, anything like that. You couldn't buy cigarettes or booze, darn it. But, you know. They paid me $50 a month extra to use my pickup. The salt they used was come out of the mines in Utah, I think.
Like big rock, from Redmond?
Yeah, big rock salt. They said, just go over to Redlands, is a camp on Babbitt's, and that's where they unload that salt. And they said, go over and get a company pickup, a company horse truck, and haul that salt. I didn't have to use my own pickup to scatter salt.
Nice.
50 a month extra. So I think when I quit, I was making $300, which was big money. And with the house, utilities, and all your groceries, $300 a month is, you know, that's pretty good money back then. But
who was managing Babbitt's back then?
Bill Howell was the boss. Pat Kane was at Redlands. Pat was, he was the boss on the W. Triangle side where I was. But Bill was the big boss. What a cowboy Bill is, and was. Great guy. And another big help, you know, we were working the herd one day and a cow ran off, broke out and ran off. And I ran down there, you know, it took quite a while and I roped her off out there and got her back. And the horse was pretty tired. I stopped up on a little hill from where they were working that herd. And Bill came up to me and I'd unsaddled, let my horse thump and he said, you know, that was fine, me roping that cow, that was good. But he was watching somebody work the herd, and they would ride up to a cow and look at her and ride around her. They're cutting dry cows. And Bill, he'd ride up and he'd look at a cow and he'd just cut her out. He'd make up that instant decision, and that's right. Your first decision's right, and that's what he was telling me. And he said, all that riding around like that, he said, that's bull. And coached on me quite a bit. He said, you ride up and look at a cow from behind, and you can tell if she's wet or dry right now. And he said, if you ride up to her from the front, you look down her back, and if her back is pretty round, she's pretty fat, 99% of the time in this country, she's going to be dry. You hardly ever see a fat, dry, or a fat, wet cow. It just helped me a lot with things like that. And he was a whale of a horseman. Helped me a lot with that. Horsemanship, his style. His horse he called Checkers was the top horse on the outfit at that point. And I had a horse he called Yellowstone. It was that full brother that was a cranky, no good sabaki. I chickened him. But he talked about Checkers and what it took to get him broke. Pretty interesting stuff. And
was Checkers one that they raced?
Yeah, they didn't have any boughten horses at that time.
Was that how it was most places? Most of them have their own?
Yeah, they all, anywhere I ever worked that bought horses in those days, you weren't nearly as well mannered as you were where they raised their own. The Yolos, I think, had 60 brood mares. The Diamond A's had 300, I think. I don't know how many mares Babbitt's had, but my camp, our camp, There were two mare bands there, about 30 mares in a band and two different studs. Okay. That's another pretty good story. Bill asked me to gather one of the studs. They called Breeze. He'd come off the track, and his colts were sorry. You know, people don't realize, some people don't realize, it takes maybe 5 years to prove a stud. You know, you breed him, anyway, it takes a long time. And that stud had not turned out to be a good one. And he said, "Skeet, gather that stud for me and his band of mares, and I'll come get him, yada, yada." He said, "But watch that stud, because he'll dang sure try to take you." So it took me maybe, maybe a week to find him there. It's a big country. And I found him, and I was coming in with him, and Breeze ran at me more than once, and he'd come up, and mouth wide open, and I'd run at him with my rope down, and that horse, that stud, turned and spun and run away from me, and he got out there maybe 50 feet, and he stepped in a cow trail, maybe that deep, maybe a foot deep, and turned a knocker. He was so clumsy that no wonder his colts were clumsy, you know. And one of the colts that I got when I went to work there that Ben had been riding, he'd started him, and he named him Rickety Andy. And that booger would fall down. Oh, I'm sorry, son of a gun. But some of them, I can talk about, you know, kind of got ahead of my story, I think. But I was with the wagon. The wagon was camped at Redlands. And Cole Morehouse was there. Cole's pretty famous. He was riding a horse they called Conejo, who was a Breeze colt and big. I don't know. You know, he was at least 16 hands tall. Big rank sucker. And Cole had got on him, and there at Redlands, there's a barn, and there's a road goes right there, and there's a place that's, I don't know, I'd say it's 12 feet high. Just a bluff right there on that road. And Cole had kind of eased him around, got up on top there, and that horse blew up with him and bucked off of that place.
Oh.
It was a looked bad. And Cole rode him, and that horse hit that, you know, it was just a gravel road, but it's hard packed, and didn't fall. Oh. And I was 100% sure he'd fall with Cole, but Cole just rode him. Have you heard much about Cole?
Mm-mm.
He's pretty famous, and a good guy. But those horses would buck. Jesse James, I saw Ben Fancher ride Jesse James. That dirty sucker could buck. I had one they called Cody that never got me bucked off. But we left Buck Tanks one morning, and I think he bucked with me 8 times. And he never got me down. He bucked my hat off. I smoked Bull Durham. He smoked my Bull Durham package out. You know. My brothers, after I quit, Charlie had him, and little Ben Fancher was there, and Cody was bucking and fell with Charlie, and they said it looked like a train wreck, that horse, you know. But he was catty. He was active. He was a clabber horse. A lot of those horses went back to clabber. But, you know, I didn't care. I kind of liked it, in fact. I mean, and there were guys, I used a night latch a lot. I couldn't have ridden Cody freehand if I'd have tried to be a, you know. I know guys say their daddy wouldn't let them, they couldn't pull leather bull. I'd rather pull leather than walk home.
Yeah.
But it's been a great life. I really enjoyed being a cowboy. It was fun. You know, I've worked in a little bit in Texas, I mean, after I growed, and a little bit in Oklahoma, I mean, just a few days. I did buy quite a few cattle in, so I was both those places buying cattle in. I got to cowboy a little bit, go with them cowboying. Nevada, Oregon, California, and Arizona, and there's good cowboys everywhere I was. They may have a little different ways, but they're all good cowboys. I never worked in Utah. There's a lot of talk about the difference between buckaroos and cowpunchers or cowboys. The good ones, there's not a whole lot of difference, in my opinion. You know, the equipment might be a little different than the Southwest. You know, Texans nearly always rode with batwing chaps. And then into New Mexico and Arizona, they wore step-in shotguns for the most part. I built a pair of chinks when I was working on the reservation, and they really laughed at me. I called them little boy chaps. But I was starting colts, working on the ground a lot, and they were warmer, cooler, they weren't as hot.
Yeah.
When I first moved over here, I was an old kid, came to work, and he was wearing a pair of Armitas, and I had never seen Armitas with all the fringe, and they looked like they were, I think they were made out of buckskin, not good heavy leather. And he was so proud of them, and I was laughing at him. It made everybody mad. But he wouldn't go where the brush is thick. He said, "No, I'll ruin my new shops." So we didn't use him anymore. But, you know, just the difference in the country. And, you know, again, my opinion, a lot of guys that worked on those bigger outfits, wherever it happened to be, Eastern Oregon, the MCs, you know, Nevada, there's several big old outfits there, like where Luke Bullmaster worked, and Brian Morris and his brother, Clark Morris. They've told me a lot of Clark and Morris both helped me and talked about the Circle A's when they had, you know, 2 million acres or whatever they had, and 500 horses plus. Things were different. But those cowboys, you know, they were just cowboys, and they could have gone anywhere, been good hands.
That concludes my episode with Skeet Gould. Like I said at the beginning, if you want to hear more of his stories, find him on Facebook, and he said he would be happy to send you a copy of his book called Laying Around the Waterhole. And also, like always, if you like what you're listening to, please leave us a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening on. And to put a face behind the name to those that we have visited with, you can head over to our Instagram page. It's @cowboystories_podcast. Thanks. We'll see you next time.